half.
Very smart gal, and she's had a lot of.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are going to open today's hearing, or excuse me, today's meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education for Thursday, February 23rd, 2017. And we are going to continue with our agency presentation on Senate Bill 5522, the Chief Education Office Budget Bill. And I will return to the stage the lovely Lindsay Capps and the also lovely Lisa Pearson from DAS. Thank you. And can I check in before we get started about KPMs, just to throw you off your game right from the beginning? No.
I have them right here.
Excellent. I know we just, I was reminded that we had just kind of finished that yesterday before you move into the key functions. And I was just curious, I was struck looking at that yesterday about, so you only have five, which seems fine because you're this kind of quasi, you know, it's not like you have the ability to directly implement because you're not a, you know, you don't have programs that you specifically implement, and I understand that. But I just wondered if you could kind of talk through the, briefly, okay, I was most struck by the fact that two of your five are both about attendance, even in those two different grades, but high school graduation is not one of them, even though that is a key transition point and a key kind of big picture thing. I just wondered if you could talk about whether you'd thought, and one of them is not third grade reading level or anything like that. So I guess I just wanted you to talk briefly about how you got to those. Is there any talk about changing those or adjusting those going forward to kind of make sure you're reflecting overall what you guys do?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, thank you for the question. I think if you were to look back at the Oregon Education Investment Board agency KPMs from prior biennia, they really ran the system. So they were aligned to our Achievement Compact metrics and our 40-40-20 goal. I think the decision-making, though, I don't believe I was particularly involved as we had a transition in our agency director in this current biennium. I think the idea around the KPMs was to try to focus in on areas where we had a specific key system coordinating role, so chronic absenteeism, early learning through K-12, and certainly looking at the educator workforce. To your question about would we be willing to look at additional KPMs? Absolutely. I think there could be KPMs that are more reflective. We are cognizant of the fact that in terms of our customers as an agency, we're oftentimes working with other state agencies as well as institutions that have a more direct impact on those outcomes. So I think it's thinking through a little bit more carefully how we best reflect our performance in that regard. But I do think we are, if there's some inferred limitation to our key performance members, I would agree with that. Great. So we'd be happy to work with the committee on that process.
Great. Thank you. Okay, key functions it is. Oh, sorry. Can you start with your name for the record, please?
Yes. For the record,
of your testimony.
Lindsay Capps, Chief Education Officer. So I believe we were just transitioning yesterday into a conversation around some of our key functions as an agency, and I will ask our policy directors and our research and SLDS directors to come up with me as we walk through this. To help present on these and talk more specifically about their work. I do want to make a connection in this process to some of the conversation we had yesterday around our strategic goals as an agency, both from a policy and a systems perspective. And so we'll try to add a little bit more meat on the bone in terms of concrete examples of that work. But before we shift to that, I just want to make sure that we differentiate the role that we play as a state agency with our other partner agencies and sectors. And part of that is our sort of system view that's a specific charge of our agency. And the shifts that I think we're trying with collaboration with the governor and the legislature to try to move across the system. So we recognize the authority and partnership that we have with state agencies and their governing boards, whether that's the Early Learning Council, the State Board of Education, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, the Youth Development Counselor, the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Each has authorities granted by statute for their work, but we also understand that those agencies and entities are specifically structured and function to serve the needs of their sectors in which they are leading or the particular area of the system that they are working to support. So there's a lot of work that's already embedded in what these agencies are doing. As an example, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission had about two dozen specific legislative mandated initiatives that they were charged with sort of convening around just within the higher ed sector after the 2015 session, and it was all good and important work, but there was a lot of work for them to do within that realm. And similarly, we have each other agency that has specific decision-making processes, regulatory responsibilities, federal and state, as well as program administration responsibilities. So what we sort of bring to that work is, I think, an additive value to help think about some systemic issues and helping to steer and coordinate more long-term solutions within the system that first and foremost address critical student barriers and around key student transitions. But the way in which we do that is, I think, very specific. So first and foremost, thinking about the ways in which we build partnerships across sectors that go beyond state agencies, but with institutional and community partners, thinking beyond the education continuum to, as we think about some of our regional education partnerships, how we're partnering with education and social services in that work, but really supporting that regional level approach. Within the education workforce, helping us shift to a more consistent statewide system of support for educators that we've talked a little bit about already, which is changing from a sort of top-down programmatic implementation process to more of a networked opportunities where teachers and school leaders have a leadership role to play in their own professional and leadership development. And certainly the statewide longitudinal data system reflects a longitudinal view of the system that doesn't exist in one agency or another, but requires a coordinating entity to sort of bring that information together and think about how the system uses that data to address key transitions or other student outcomes. And the last and important piece, I think this has been raised by a couple of members of this subcommittee, is we have the opportunity to do evaluation of policies, programs, and practices with sort of a neutral third-party lens on that. I think oftentimes institutions, certainly state government is guilty of this, school districts, et cetera, we sort of do things a certain way, and that's the way we've always done it, so if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But there may be ways, especially as we think about the use of longitudinal data and looking at long-term trends and student outcomes, that we can actually help move and disseminate best practices. I think you're going to hear from the innovation officer in a few minutes here to talk a little bit about what that looks like in terms of our high school graduation outcomes, but that covers all the work of the agency. That's our clear focus. The second piece I'll say, and then we'll transition to get into the meat of this, is our commitment around equity, as I talked a little bit about yesterday, is really about bringing policymaking out to communities, not only to talk with practitioners who are serving our students, but to engage community partners in this work in a more coherent way. So we've seen this around our convening authority as an agency, or function, more importantly, in terms of our chronic absenteeism work, to take a community-focused lens on what's truly impacting students and their families and contributing to those trends and disturbing trends in our system. Certainly, the Education Innovation Officer's work to go out and talk to students, families, and communities about what do they see as being effective practices to help us move graduation outcomes has been a representation of that approach. And then our Council on Educator Advancement convening, we brought in not only legislators and state policymakers, but we were bringing in teachers and school administrators and equity advocates to really engage in a conversation about how we build a better system. From all of those efforts, that convening opportunity, our hope is really to build effective systems to connect good practice and good strategies to support student success, and to help us better think about what policies we need to enact in collaboration with the legislature to remove those barriers that students too often see. So this is not the work of one agency alone. It's not the executive branch's job alone. It's really a collaboration not only with the legislature but with communities across the state. So I think you'll see that reflected as we talk about our key functions as an agency. First and foremost, we want to make sure that all of our students are college and career ready. Secondarily, focus on the cultural competency, diversity, and effectiveness of our education workforce. The work of our research and policy unit to support a longitudinal approach to research and policy and program evaluation, and ultimately the building of a data system that helps link all of those pieces together. So with that, we'll start with college and career readiness, and I'll ask Colt Gill and Hilda Roselli to join me. And just to frame this a little bit, when we talk about a focus on college and career readiness, this is obviously an effort that starts in our early learning work and through our K-12 system. But an area that we're really focused on specifically is around the student transition grades 11 through 14 as we think about helping to develop pathways from our K-12 system into a college career or into a place in the workforce. And some of our goals in this area are first and foremost to develop shared knowledge across the agencies and organizations and partners about, one, our progress toward meeting college and career readiness goals as we have defined those, identifying continued areas of need, where do we have gaps in the system that we need to address, and particularly focusing on disparities that continually persist in the system. The other piece that I think comes out of that work, not only in having shared goals and bringing together collaboration and focus, is our ability to think about ways in which each sector within their areas of authority can put in place policies and practices that help achieve those goals. We ultimately need to be thinking about how we allocate resources effectively in that way from a state perspective, but there's a lot of work that can happen at the institutional level as well to move that forward and across sectors. With the governor's appointment of our education innovation officer, we certainly recognize, as we talked in an earlier presentation, about the important issue we have ahead of us in terms of addressing our high school graduation rate. And certainly embedded in that are the disparities we see in outcomes, and certainly the contributing factor that chronic absenteeism is playing in those outcomes. In creating the Education Innovation Officer position within the Chief Education Office, Governor Brown was looking to have someone with a singular focus on strategies specific to high school graduation within the larger P20 work that we help to coordinate. And it's the role of the Education Innovation Officer is really around engagement with schools, communities, and researchers to identify and help replicate and scale up effective practices. The Innovation Officer works with me and my statutory responsibilities as Chief Education Officer, as well as our Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, to propose strategies, accountability measures, and budget priorities specific to high school graduation. So with that, I will turn it over to Colt Gill.
Okay, flip one more slide there. Co-Chair Smith, Warner, and Moreau, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Colt Gill, Education Innovation Officer for Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to our graduation work to date. This visual reflects the way I go about the work and the myriad of perspectives and inputs that were solicited in the development of recommendations to the governor. With our limited time this morning, I'd like to share just three interconnected efforts that come together to move high-leverage, sustainable, and I think economical strategies that are designed to improve our graduation outcomes in Oregon. So first, it was critical that as we began this work from a state level to reach out and develop strong partnerships with students, families, communities, and schools across the state to ensure that their ideas and voices are clearly reflected in any kind of statewide policy that we would ask the governor to endorse. For the last 27 years, I've worked in districts on the other side of the state and local partnership, so I really understand how important it is to have that local perspective in order to have the success of any kind of statewide initiative. Through our engagement process, I was able to connect with over 1,000 participants this summer and fall. They represented dozens of communities across 32 of our counties. The feedback was remarkably consistent around two themes. One of those was equitable practices and outcomes, and the second was development of strong relationships, partnerships, and relevance for our students. Beyond those two themes, though, we heard about 10 key strategies that are promising in local communities across the state in preparing, supporting, and engaging our students and their families on the path to graduation. So those strategies can be found on page 54 of this report, which I think you received at the beginning of our presentation Monday. This report, along with a review of successful practices in other states, forms the basis of the policies put forward in Senate Bill 183, the Graduation Equity Fund. The Graduation Equity Fund tightens our practices specifically for the 25% of students, or that 150,000 students that are currently in our schools that our schools are not effectively supporting on a path to graduation right now. Our community member from Redmond, during my visit, I think stated this really well. She said, "I believe that the single student-centric factor contributing to student graduation rates is that students don't feel as though they matter in our schools. Their culture, interests, dreams, and goals don't matter. Students perceive this from educators, administrators, parents, and others. Individuals in poverty, minorities, and others are repeatedly told by society that they don't matter, and unfortunately, in many ways, our educational system compounds this. After all, when you don't have much, everything you do have is magnified." So I think if we truly want to improve our statewide graduation outcomes, we must focus on all our students, especially those who have been marginalized. So second, this same engagement process also guided our collaborative approach to developing policy to ensure that Measure 98, the High School Graduation and College and Career Readiness Act, achieves the improved graduation outcomes that we're all hoping for. I've been facilitating an interagency team put together by Salam Noor, Ben Cannon, and Lindsay Capps, focused on working with stakeholders to inform that policy that will help ensure the act is implemented in a way that will positively impact students that our current practices are not currently working for. So finally, and related to both those previous efforts, I'm also co-leading with Salam Noor a team across the Oregon Department of Education, the Chief Education Office, Youth Development Division, Early Learning Division, and HEC, among some other key stakeholders, to consider how from a statewide approach to translate promising practices and the voices of our community members into policy, and then subsequently translating that policy into new and effective practices and partnerships in our local schools and communities. So this policy to practice effort requires ongoing engagement with community partners, districts, and researchers. The Chief Education Office is really in a unique position to develop local partnerships because of the established support system it has in place with our regional achievement collaboratives across the state, our STEM hubs, our early learning hubs, ESDs, and other partnering systems. To further the collaboration, I have also worked to develop research-based partnerships with districts that we can all learn from. So one of these partnerships, just as an example, includes 8 Oregon districts that are consistently beating the odds and the state performance rates on graduation. I have the opportunity to meet regularly with these 8 districts, along with the Oregon Leadership Network and Education Northwest, to do some action research around their successful efforts in order to better understand how we can support other districts in replicating the results these districts are getting. So I'm only a few months into this new position, and there is more underway than I'm able to illustrate here this morning, but I feel we are making strong headway by empowering local voice in developing models and the systems of support our districts can employ to improve outcomes for our students.
Senator Monroe?
Yes, Mr. Gill, you mentioned the 8 districts
yes.
that are exceeding expectations. Can you tell us who those 8 are?
Yes, I can. And they're not the only 8 in Oregon.
Yeah.
So there are clearly some that outperform. I'd prefer, just to make sure I don't, because I'm working with 3 groups like this, that I don't interchange them, if I could send that to you after the meeting today.
Okay.
And I'll send you the entire list and the team at Northwest and Oregon Leadership Network that support the effort as well. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
This work in Oregon is both challenging and urgent. We have a generation of students whose future opportunities, I think, are being limited by the lack of a diploma and really even that sense of pride and accomplishment from successfully finishing high school.
And Mr. Gill, could you, we've had a request, could you submit your testimony as well? There's some
Absolutely.
Interesting information in there. Thank you.
Okay. So moving from our high school graduation focus to the high school to post-secondary transition, Hilda Roselli, our College and Career Readiness Director.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Monroe and Smith Warner and committee members. It's a pleasure. My name is Hilda Roselli, and I serve in the Chief Education Office as the Policy Director for College and Career Readiness and Educator Advancement. And I'm very excited today to be able to share very specific examples of the work that we are doing and how it is impacting policy and action. More and more, we know that the space between connecting high schools and what happens for those students after they leave high school has to be a shared space. It has to be a shared space with multiple stakeholders at the table. And in the past, we all know that we had a lot of siloed systems. So one of the things that we do at the Chief Education Office is that we have an interagency policy and planning team that, first of all, represents all of our state agencies. So it's, HEC and ODE. We also have YDD and early learning to really look at what are our shared goals and then to examine policy and legislation, look for where there's synergy, where there could be better efficiencies, where we're duplicating efforts in a way without knowing, and then also really recommending the consolidation of good actions and practices that we can advise to legislators and to other policy makers. Secondly, almost monthly, the Chief Education Office convenes a group that is called, for lack of a better term, the College and Career Readiness Cross-Sector Planning Group. Long title. But one of the things that's interesting is that when we started this back in 2013, there were only about 10 of us. And what happened was in my new job, I realized I didn't have all the answers. I didn't know what was going on in the state. And so I started talking to people and they would tell me, oh, I didn't know they were doing that. And I realized I wasn't the only one sort of operating, by myself. And so we brought this group together, and you may recall that we actually developed a definition for the state of college and career readiness, which was approved and accepted by all of the education boards and commissions back in 2014. Well, while we did that work, we realized we needed to expand the group. So it now includes people from the Employment Department, Gear Up, Oregon Career Information Systems, EPIC, Education Northwest, the Office of Student Access and Completion, the Oregon Community College Association, the GED Office, the Alliance of Private Institutions, and then, because word got out, partners in the field who were doing this work and passionate about it asked to come to the meeting. And we said, sure, we always have an open line. But then I will tell you that just last month, we actually had 90 people indicate interest in a discussion on a Friday afternoon for 3 hours about vertical alignment between high schools and post-secondary. We realize this is a gap that our state has not resolved yet. And as we brought a panel of practitioners forward to listen to them to figure out what's working, where are the gaps and what are the needs, we're able then to be able to funnel that information into better practices and policies. Thirdly, as Lindsay Capps mentioned yesterday, the Chief Education Office is convening and facilitating a Sustainable Systems for Accelerated Learning group that includes superintendents, presidents, and provosts of community colleges and universities. And you may ask yourself, why are we focusing again on accelerated learning? Some of us remember other committees that have been formed and met, but I will tell you that the evidence is still very clear. In our state alone, we tracked students from 2011-12 through 2014-15. We learned that, first of all, students in high school who have access to college coursework, their graduation rate exceeds that of all Oregon students by almost 20 percentage points. Secondly, the average persistence rate for those students who move on to college following graduation from first to second year, for all of those students, for everybody, it's 73%. But for those that went through some dual credit coursework in their high school years, that rate was 81.3%. And overall, if you think about just the enrollment patterns, that's why we have to keep focusing on the innovation that was started through some of the regional promise projects that were funded by this legislature. So one of the things that will be happening is this group will be meeting probably six times. We'll be convening to look at some sustainable recommendations for you about how do we deal with funding when currently funding goes to one sector, K-12, and another funding goes to post-secondary. And yet, what we've learned is that collaboration between these two has to involve high school teachers working with community college and university professors. And somebody has to fund that. And if the state doesn't kind of provide some guideposts around what is needed to make that work sustainable, then we are hit and miss or dependent only on project-based grants. We will also be looking at the issues around dual credit instructors. It's back up on the table again. We now have standards. We now have standards that say certain models have figured out a solution, but statewide, we don't have that happening across the board. And so when you talk about high school instructors that want to be able to teach those courses, we have to figure that out. And I would also suggest that we have to find the way to fund their time and their commitment to this work. There are a number of other things that I could share with you that we are engaged in doing, but I think I'll stop at this point, as those are examples that show how we work. Oh, I will share one other thing. Because we built relationships, we meet regularly, we can call somebody immediately, we know where to find some data, we don't have that all resolved yet, but it's coming along. When the legislature passed Senate Bill 418 in 2015, which asked for a task force that HEC convened, we were able to all participate in that work group and then come back to you in the short session with recommendations for how $4 million that was set aside could be best used to support our counselors, to bring together advisors and counselors from post-secondary and high schools, to look at AVID-like programming for high schools to get kids ready for college expectations, to fund developmental education research, and to provide some seed money to those regions around the state that had no partnerships developed yet. That work is only in its embryonic stage. It's not yet fully developed. And what we did learn, what we're doing the evaluation for you on that work, is that that has to be sustained in some way. We are looking for ways to do that, and we also feel as though the support from all of these individuals that are getting together more regularly now is moving a culture that's permeating our state to say to students, you don't stop at high school. You're going on to careers, or you're going on to post-secondary education. So that's another example of really how we are working as a group together.
Okay, cool. Move on to a second area of work and a function of our agency, and that has to do with our career-connected learning. As I talked about yesterday, we work with the STEM Investment Council that was established in 2013 to guide our investments around STEM or STEAM education. And as you see here on the slide, these are the statutory goals that have been established, of which the STEM Council and our STEM CTE policy director are working in an interagency capacity to support and cross-sector capacity to support. So as you'll see up here, we have a requirement that by 2025, we have double the amount of students proficient in math and science. That's within our K-12 system at certain grade levels. And by 2025, double the post-secondary STEM degrees and certificates. The idea, obviously, being that we are connecting a pathway from our K-12 to our higher education system to ensure that more of our students are moving on to high-demand, high-wage careers. And this is very closely connected with the work that we do around career technical education, which is largely housed at the Oregon Department of Education, but is certainly a focus of ours in trying to think about more how we integrate those two efforts, as they both represent important applied hands-on learning opportunities for our students. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mark to talk a little bit about how we're doing in terms of reaching those outcomes.
Thank you, Lindsay. Co-chairs Smith Warner, Co-chair Monroe, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Mark Lewis. I work at the Chief Education Office as the Policy Director for STEM and CTE. And it is a pleasure to be here with you this morning to talk a little bit about how we are working with other state agencies to really accelerate transformations in how we're approaching the learning of STEM and career technical education to connect educational aspirations to careers and our economic development of our communities. Breakthroughs in science and technology are changing every aspect of our job, of our world and our lives, and the pace of those changes are only accelerating. We don't have to look too far into our own lives to see how technology is impacting the rate of exchange of information, how we feed the billions of people in this world, and how we communicate with each other. According to the Oregon Department of Education, over 20% of the jobs in the Oregon economy are high-wage, high-demand STEM jobs. The projections are that by 2024, that there will have been, over the next 10 years, 150,000 STEM jobs needed in the state of Oregon. About 40% of those are growth jobs. About 60% of those are replacement jobs. It is without a doubt that these are high wage, high demand, and are driving the economic prosperity of our communities and individuals in our state. I want to talk a little bit about the specific goals of the council as they are, as the legislature established in statute for the STEM Investment Council. The first one, as you see, is doubling the percentage of students at fourth and eighth grade who are proficient or advanced in math and science. You'll see in these graphs that we have quite a ways to go by 2025 to double that percentage based on the assessments that we have here. If we look at the National Assessment for Educational Progress, these numbers are even more dismal, quite honestly. In math, they hover between 34 and 37%. In science, it's 34 and 36%. But that's not the story, really, of the STEM Investment Council, because our society really doesn't need more rememberers. And these assessments don't necessarily reflect the charge of the council, who are really trying to think about the educational system, about how do we inspire the thinkers and dreamers and doers of tomorrow, and move well beyond students being consumers of information to be creators of that knowledge. So we think, or the council has in the STEM education plan that was recently produced at the end of last year, has put forward some additional indicators to try to frame out and add additional context to those goals. I'll go. Here, as we're looking at the fact that the charge of our educational system is not just to move people through graduation, but actually prepare them for their futures. When we look at the throughput of the system right now in terms of doubling the numbers of students who are earning a post-secondary degree in a STEM-related field, and actually compare that to the demand of our business and industries in the state, it is stark. So if we look at the pure numbers here, we're looking at about 4,000 graduates who are earning a STEM degree in a post-secondary STEM degree. If we look at that 150,000 number that I said earlier, and we just say, okay, over those 10 years, let's produce, 15,000 STEM degree holders each year, and we look at these numbers then, and if we double it right now, we're still only reaching half of the demand. If we continue at the current figures, we're talking about a 75% gap between what we're producing in the state of Oregon and the needs of our business and industries to drive the economic growth and prosperity, which also then generates revenue for the state. So where do business and industries get that talent? They're going to have to import it. And that's, we're concerned greatly that we're having Oregon students for Oregon jobs. So I want to move on to talk a little bit about the actual investments that were recommended by the STEM Investment Council, the last biennium, and went through a process with the Oregon Education Investment Board to put in front of the legislature in the last biennium for implementation by the Chief Ed Office in collaboration with the Department of Education and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. So we're stewards of these, but working in very close partnership with our other agencies. Chrissy Hewitt will talk a lot more about our regional STEM Hub efforts, so I want to not say too much about those right now. But I do want to highlight one example of the work that they are doing. In STEM Week last year, for a single week at the beginning of May, they reached over 17,000 students and 2,000 educators in a single week around STEM activities across the state.
So, Representative Wisnett. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lewis, can you give us a definition of what of underserved and underrepresented? What is that?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Wisnett. The federal definition for underserved, underrepresented students are those who are from, are traditionally underrepresented, those who are not participating in those STEM opportunities at the same rate as their demographic percentages. So this generally falls into the realm of students who are facing poverty. First-generation students, several of our rural students fall into that category. Certainly our African-American, Native American, Pacific Islander populations, Latino-Latina populations, those are all included in that definition.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Women in many of those.
Okay, my interest was ELL and students from poverty. So you're saying that's part of it, but you're expecting.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Okay. Excuse me, Senator Monroe.
Yeah, Mr. Lewis. I was at Intel, I don't know, a year or so ago, and I was kind of taken aback because it seemed like 80% of their employees were from India. Is that because we're just not producing technical people at a high enough rate in this state?
Senator Monroe, Representative Smith-Warner, members of the committee, I think our business and industries in this global economy seek talent wherever they can find it. Yeah. I think that from what I've heard from our business and industry partners in this work is that they would vastly prefer to hire local employees who have the talents and skills necessary to help them be successful in their businesses.
Okay, Senator Thompson?
You kind of went around that question.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you. In regard to the In regard to these investments that you see up here on the screen, I think it's important to note that when these recommendations were put forward, one of the things that was driving the thinking was that we've seen a number of programs stood up in this state and in other states in terms of grants, and that there was a recognition that by and large we're program rich and systems poor, that these investments needed to work in concert with each other in order to accelerate the transformations in the systems and to meet the needs of those students who are not being served. And so these investments were designed to work in concert together to accelerate that change in and create a more effective system and to maximize impact. For example, many of the recipients of the STEM innovation grants that you see there in terms of, you know, increasing success in mathematics, driving additional opportunities for students to take advantage of digital literacy and computer science, and then out-of-school programs for underserved, underrepresented students, all really work collaboratively with the STEM hubs themselves, knowing that not every district and not every community is a participant in those STEM hubs. There are those districts also participating in these grants as well. So it's not just those districts who are participating in STEM hubs right now that take advantage of these grants.
Okay. So now we'll shift to talk a little bit about our work with regional education partnerships, the STEM hubs being an example of that. But just to talk a little bit about the importance of this in terms of, as Mark just mentioned, sort of us being systems poor, the opportunity that we have by working across regions in building partnerships, whether that be the early learning hubs that are really focused in on ensuring that students are, or children are ready for school, or our STEM hubs that have a very specific focus around STEM and increasingly CTE programs and partnerships to support that across districts in the state and at post-secondary institutions, or our regional achievement collaboratives, which really serve as the P20 regional entity. I think over 90% of our regional education partnerships, or our RACs, are focused on college and career readiness as a goal, but it, going after that goal and outcome in different contextualized ways within their regions. So Chrissy Hewitt is our Regional Education Partnership Policy Advisor, and talk a little bit more about the work with the RACs.
Great. Thank you, Lindsay. Good morning, Co-Chair Senator Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner. For the record, my name is Dr. Chrissy Hewitt, and I'm the Regional Education Partnership Policy Advisor for the Chief Education Office. I'm happy to be able to share a little bit with you about these different partnerships. Could you switch the slide? That we work with across the state, and a little bit about our role and leadership in the Chief Education Office. So as you can see up there, Lindsay mentioned, we have STEM hubs, early learning hubs, and regional achievement collaboratives. The Chief Education Office has been able to provide strategic and direction and oversight to several of these partnerships, as well as work collaboratively across the agencies to increase some synergy and alignment. The other piece of our leadership has been in really thinking about what makes an effective partnership and what outcomes are we seeking at a systems level. We know we're looking to increase high school graduation and other outcomes, but we've also been working with communities and with other leaders to think about effective partnerships. And we have looked at really five indicators and are piloting a study around governance diversity, so both culturally and linguistically in communities, as well as sector representation, because it's important to have business, industry, healthcare, all of those people at the table when you're making these regional decisions. We've heard that from the committee and from our other projects. As well as partner and community engagement. So we've talked about modeling that on the state level, but these are sort of systems to try to get to that at a regional level, as well as use of evidence and data and decision-making and processes at the regional level. As well as some visibility in the community, we're also looking at how partnerships are perceived by their community, press releases, things that they've been able to achieve and work on together holistically across sectors, as well as one really important one, which is related to a return on investment. So we've been looking at a way to think about streamlining how we look at leverage and aligning of resources with partnerships in a resource-constrained environment in particular. We need to think about efficiencies in the system. And what we've been doing is piloting a study, particularly right now with the STEM hubs, and thinking about what resources, both monetary and in-kind, because volunteer support, board support, when you have CEOs on your committee, they have a high dollar time that they're contributing to these efforts. So we're looking at both monetary and in-kind supports for these in the communities. So that's sort of the strategy overall in looking at these. And we're right now in the process of investigating good tools to be able to do that that are both helpful for continuous improvement for communities and helpful for us as investors. I wanted to say, to talk a little bit about the STEM hubs, not a ton, because this actually is in the Oregon Department of Education budget, so they'll talk a little bit more about the hubs later. But we do provide some strategic direction and oversight to that work as they try to increase access, interest, and attainment in STEM and STEAM education in their communities. I wanted to share one particular note of an outcome that we've seen from our pilot study. Right now, we have preliminary data on the leveraged resources for the first cohort of STEM hubs, which is 6 STEM hubs in the state across different regions. We have noted that they've leveraged more than $6 million in funds across a variety of funding sources, and that's compared to an original $2.5 million total state hub investment. So this includes other state grants that they've been leveraging and aligning, other grants, national community foundation grants, as well as in-kind resources from volunteer time, space, staff dedication. So it's been really impressive to watch that roll out. And those hubs actually have, we've been looking at the possibility that they could reach over 100,000 students, and that may not be through direct services and programs. Mark mentioned the different investments that are working in concert. It may also be the systems piece, where they're actually touching educators that touch students, or they're working to align the programs in their regions to ultimately impact students. So a little bit about the Early Learning Hub. So we work closely with Early Learning Division staff to create some common efforts along STEM and early learning and other efforts such as metrics and things like that. I also want to talk about particularly the regional achievement collaboratives, because they come from our budget in particular. So with funding from the legislature, the Chief Education Office supports 13 collaboratives across the state. And they unite partners and developed aligned actions, bringing together education institutions, communities, based organizations, industry, and healthcare. And I wanted to give one specific example of how this is happening in a community. So our Better Together Central Oregon RAC is actually implementing a Latino Success Initiative. And their goal is to build an aligned pipeline of supports from cradle to career for Latino students. So this has involved region-wide adoption and implementation of a number of student programs championed by that RAC. And for the first time, all 6 districts adopted those this spring. So due to this alignment between those programs, they now serve over 500 students and families, up from just 100 4 years ago. And they're also seeing gaps in attendance and graduation rates closing rapidly. So we are seeing efforts in communities that are regionally specific that are being impactful to students. As far as, can you switch the slide? Oh, God. As far as I wasn't paying attention. As far as investments go, we have supported the 13 racks with $42,000 per biennium to build capacity for implementing cross-sector partnerships. This has often gone to a tiny fraction of staff time for the efforts that they're actually putting in to move this work forward. We've had $200,000 for efforts to connect leaders across a statewide network and to enable sharing of promising practices. This is both region-to-region sharing, because we know that, you know, this work is hard, and we're developing regional leadership around this work, and we want them to be able to share practices with each other around community and family engagement. So in addition to our initial capacity building investments, Dr. Roselli mentioned Senate Bill 418. We had $700,000 that was appropriated to the Chief Education Office that actually was distributed to the Regional Achievement Collaborative Network for working on the college and career readiness, particularly high school to post-secondary transitions, as Lindsay mentioned. I wanted to end just by talking about also the ability to increase the feedback loop between policy and practice with the regional leadership that we're developing across the state. We've used this network as policymakers, as leaders in the community engagements with the Education Innovation Officer, as well as chronic absenteeism focus groups. So we're looking at building leaders who can actually impact policy. And we've heard from more than one group that this work has actually helped develop regional identity. So often in Eastern Oregon, we have one big block that goes all the way down the side. And we've heard from Southeast Oregon, actually, that now they're at the table, they're being able to make decisions as leaders, and those practices are being highlighted. So I wanted to lastly end with a quote. It says, from one of our South Coast RAC leaders, it says, "Thank you for giving me the opportunity to serve my community in this unique, challenging, and meaningful manner. I love every minute of this work, and I'm constantly learning and improving the relationships this position has enabled me to form. I've been an educator for decades, but never have I been so privileged as to actually have dedicated time to build understanding and relationships with such diverse and inspiring groups of people. I wish I had done this prior to entering education profession. It would have made me a better teacher, administrator, and change maker." Thank you.
Thank you. And Lindsay, I just wanted to do a time check.
Yes.
So we've been on for about 50 minutes, and we've gotten through, I think, about 12 slides, and we have about 20 or 30 left to go.
Okay.
So pacing. And I don't think we can go to Monday.
Madam President,
we've pushed back. Yeah, I was going to say we've moved TSPC back to Monday definitive. So, and I know there's a lot of good information, and we all appreciate it.
So our next,
and we will be coming back to a lot of it. Both a lot of Excellent. It will get covered in the ODE presentation, as well as in our later committee meetings as well.
Thank you. So we'll talk just briefly about our work around educator workforce. I'm going to move past some of the workforce data. I think we've talked a little bit about this in previous panels, and just sort of move us forward in terms of the goals of our work. And I think we've, as we've talked about yesterday in our strategic plan, we have two focuses, certainly the diversity of the workforce and in establishing a continuum of supports for our education workforce. So we also have a focus around our Educator Equity Advisory Committee that is making recommendations that some of which are reflected in Senate Bill 182 that is part of the Council for Educator Advancement work. So why don't we
I was able to attend one of their convenings, and it was very powerful. It was a very powerful meeting and conversation.
So maybe I will hand it over to Dr. Roselli to talk a little bit about the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning, of which we provide some strategic direction toward.
So besides engaging with the ODE staff and practitioners to drive the work of the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning, we have two very specific functions that we provide. One is that we maintain a Teach in Oregon website to provide future educators with a one-stop shop to find out anything they might need to know about moving forward on a pathway towards becoming an educator. We also coordinate and administer a statewide educator survey on teaching and learning conditions that you'll see in our POP. And there were three items on the 2016 tell that related to professional development that were very disturbing to many of us, and they made us reflect on the core principles of this network and ask ourselves, are we doing everything we can to embody those? One is that only 51% of the 16,000 teachers who answered the survey agreed that professional development in Oregon is differentiated to meet their needs. 40% noted a lack of follow-up in professional development. So I go to something and then I go back to my classroom and nothing changes. And only 46% believe that professional development in Oregon is actually evaluated and that the results are shared and communicated in a way that helps them make wise choices in the future. So in 2017, the Council on Educator Advancement, which was formed from an executive order from the governor, took very seriously these results, and they focused two of their 10 recommendations specifically on how to improve professional learning access and delivery across the state. They noted that it must be ongoing and embedded and connected to practices and aligned to goals in the school, and that it had to be collaborative. So they've recommended, and you'll see this in the report that you've received, that Oregon use, first of all, adopt and use the National Learning Forward standards that talk about what real high-quality professional development looks like. Embed those with some equity-driven practices around our state so that we can be sure when we move forward with the ESSA plan that districts know how to use their Title IIA dollars to support educators and the council's education advancement fund that is referenced in Senate Bill 182 actually has guidelines for how we say state funds should be used to support educators in a way that there's accountability and high quality. Lastly, I just want to share that we've worked closely with districts, enabling them to use the results of that TEL survey. David Douglas School District worked together with administrators and teachers, and looking at their results, it resulted in a district-wide professional learning plan that deepened classroom assessment for kids and for teachers, looking at what kinds of practices would help them do a better job of that. The plan was widely accepted, and the reason for that was that everybody recognized that it was coming from data that was coming from teachers and administrators. So at that point, I think I...
We can move on.
Yep, yeah. Move on.
Thank you.
Thank you. I forgot to mention for the record, my name is Hilda Maselli, classroom teacher, educator, preparer, dean of a college of ed, and now policy director.
So now we'll shift to our research and policy unit, which is a specific program funded within the Chief Education Office. And I'll introduce our interagency policy director, Peter Tromba.
Thank you very much, Lindsay. For the record, my name is Peter Tromba, and I'm the Interagency Policy Research Director at the Chief Education Office. Very happy to be able to address this committee and let you know about the work that we're doing. First of all, now that you've heard a lot about the policy advisors and the work of the Chief Education Office, you can see how we fit. We have policy leadership that all has research needs, college and career, STEM, and all the other areas that we've mentioned. And our responsibility is to provide analysis and direction in some cases and feedback and information to those policy leads so that they can do their work in the best way possible. The way we do that is we take advantage of how the Chief Education Office is structured, what our charge is. We collaborate and we direct some of the planning among the research staff that exists at the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, Department of Ed, Youth Development, Early Learning, TSPC, and actually also OHA and some other cross-sector membership that are not strictly part of the education sector. We have a small unit, two full-time researchers and then myself, and then one other researcher who shares with us for about a day a week. So the way that we accomplish getting that feedback and information to all of the policy leads is by incredible partnerships and wonderful work that goes on in those different agencies by those other researchers. And I think it's important to note that at those different agencies, that work goes on often invisibly on the sidelines to be able to prepare, you know, reports and stuff that folks here see. But one specific cut on research that we have in our office that I think is notable and different is that we don't just prepare graphs and we don't just prepare tables, although graphs and tables are fine and great. Most of us know that depending on the presentation method of a graph or a table, you can tell all kinds of different stories. And the fact is that as a researcher, you can't tell when you're looking at a graph or a table often whether something correlates to each other or what causes what or two things just coincident to each other. The way you figure that out is you do something called a mixed method approach. You don't just use numbers, but you also use interviews. You use other qualitative methods to verify or bolster what you're seeing in the numbers. And oftentimes that takes place over a series of steps. And so we take advantage of things like Colt Gill's work, for instance, going around the states, talk to people, because the content of those conversations either helps validate what the numbers are saying or presents a real question. Like, well, what people are saying on the ground doesn't actually jibe with what we're seeing in the numbers. And that leads us to do further inquiry. And the other key partnership that we have that I've got to point out and give a couple examples of, especially after yesterday's discussion, is about the State Longitudinal Data System. Some of you might know that's what originally took me out of being a school district employee where I'd been for most of my career up to state work. And in my position as policy and research, doing policy and research work, I'm a close partner and our team is a close partner with John Starr and the SLDS team to make sense of that data system as it emerges. So, for instance, as a former high school principal, what might the SLDS be used for? Why would that be powerful, or why would research be important in that area? One example is, as a high school principal, it was really interesting to us when the chancellor's office from the university system used to tell me how the seniors from our high school did in their four-year program. We used to get this report. It wasn't at the student level, and it didn't include community college or any other kind of professional technical, but it was something. And it was very compelling for teachers at that building to be able to see the actual longitudinal outcomes of the kids that we touched at North Eugene. Well, in our system, not only are people going to be able to see it at the four-year university level, they're going to be able to see it at the two-year level, professional technical experience, and for some students out into the workforce. And so the research work that we do in our office is going to be germane all the way down to the building level, family level, and individual level to be able to look at longitudinal outcomes. And if you think about it as a parent, that's all you care about. I mean, you don't really care necessarily about a snapshot of one year's performance at a particular school. You want to know how individuals, like your kids or kids you care about or whatever, how their pathway went. So we're working with the SLDS team to find ways to visualize longitudinal data in a way that makes sense of all this great stuff that's in the SLDS for stakeholders.
Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. A quick question. How do you apply the equity lens, or can you give a quick example of how do you apply the equity lens in your research?
Yeah, yes. Co-chairs Smith Warner and Monroe, members of the committee, thanks very much for the question. It's a really long answer, but just briefly, let me just say that the equity lens often is a graph. At the end of a study, it's a graph about disaggregated data, and we do that. But really, the equity lens affects the whole research process from soup to nuts, starting with what question do you ask, proceeding to what methodology do you use, and then getting on to how you do your analysis and how you present your data. For instance, in the chronic absenteeism study, the question we asked was, from the perspective of students who are historically less likely to attend school full-time, what is their perspective? That and an analysis of who doesn't attend school is much more common if it's a student of color, student in poverty navigating the system, student who's learning English as a second language, special education student. So the equity lens focuses you on who do you sample, whose focus groups do you make sure you make sure that you actually do a focus group? If you just hold a focus group at your average high school at 3 o'clock p.m. on a Tuesday, the people that you get there are going to be one group of folks. It's probably not the folks who are most likely to miss school. So the equity lens tells you that the way you go about asking the question and answering it matters to get all voices heard. And that we've got lots of examples of that in the research that we've produced, and I'd be happy to share more of that if you're interested.
Thank you.
With respect to trauma-informed practices, the third bullet on there, that's just a great example of how we do as an office occasionally actually get our hands into actual on-the-ground research, in this case determining through a pilot in a couple of Oregon schools what is trauma-informed practice and how does it affect schools specifically? What does it cost and what are the expected outcomes? And that's an area that we've taken on that's an emerging question that, frankly, as a state, we need to get ahead of, because it's really, really easy to run in a lot of different directions. And part of our role is to help guide that work.
Can I just ask, and in the interest of time, I'm actually going to ask if you can send us a little more information. It's just on the longitudinal data. Can you send us some information to be put in the record about just kind of like outlining the history of our attempt at establishing a longitudinal data, when it started, just kind of a timeline, other states that do or don't do it, and kind of what the main challenges and just kind of a summary of that. It's something that we may come back to later in committee work, but I feel like for this conversation, it would be interesting to know that, because it's just a term I think we've all heard floating around for quite some time, and I'd be interested in getting a little more concrete information on that.
We will do that.
Thank you.
You have a list of the highlights of the reports over the last biennium or work that the office has done. If there's questions about any individual ones, please let us know. The most recent products of the office have to do with the work of the Oregon's innovation officer regarding graduation, and also work regarding how districts, K-12 districts, serve students who are in poverty. And that's just released report that I'm very interested in engaging in at some point with a group like this, because it has to do with dollars and cents and how that plays out from a revenue and budget perspective on the ground with districts. And some of our discoveries there, again, using mixed methods, are pretty compelling. The only other highlight I do want to mention, and Dr. Lindsay will talk about this in the POP part of the presentation, we have a thirst among university researchers in Oregon and their students to get access to state data like the SLDS for their doctoral students to do research on Oregon. A lot of the research that goes on in our state is done on other states' students and their systems, because their data systems are better. A lot of people get their doctorate about Chicago. And one thing that we're gonna start to, no offense to Chicago, great stuff, but it doesn't match with a lot of Oregon districts. We're gonna be able to leverage the engine of Oregon research institutions and their doctoral and master's students through partnering with them, with the SLDS and state research questions that are of interest to us, and also turn out to be of interest to professors who have kids in our state and students. And then finally, still do a little bit of that? Should I just accelerate that? Yeah. Just briefly, the final slide having to do with trauma-informed practices. And this topic is of its in itself, again, very, very deep and topical. So there's a lot of information here. I want to call out a couple things. Number one is, it's wonderful to be in the lead in this particular position working on the trauma-informed pilot. But really, we are partnering and really are learners with the Oregon Department of Education and especially the Oregon Health Authority, who are leaders in terms of partnering in our state to understand how we serve students, not just academic needs, but their behavioral needs, their mental health needs, their physical health needs, their dental health needs, and all of that, and how those come together at one time for individual students and families. And so the trauma-informed practices pilot that we're working on, that's being offered in two Oregon high schools, is a partnership project to understand how best that partnership can play out on the ground to improve attendance rates, improve graduation for all of our students. And I would be remiss if I didn't say, because we just met with Trauma-Informed Oregon yesterday, and it's just an important thing for folks to understand. Trauma-informed environments benefit every single one of us. So yes, it's true that some of us have had different experiences growing up, and some of us have more factors in resiliency and privilege and all these different things. But trauma-informed practices is a universal intervention to make our environments safer and better learning environments for all students. So when you think of it, it's not about a tiny percentage of students, although it's very critical that we serve their needs. It's about all of our needs in a learning environment to be the best learners. So thank you very much for the opportunity to present.
Senator Robin.
Just a big, quick question.
Yes.
Is there a possibility in the future that this database will be rich enough that it has all the information in it that schools are giving to it to feed it, that all of the reports and stuff that we produce from schools could be answered from a question from the State Department to this database instead of asking each school to work out their own reports over and over again and sending lots of paper?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee, we talked about that exact question because you asked it yesterday, John, as we were walking back to the office. And it is not a deliverable and not within the scope of the current system, which is about, and John's going to talk about it in just a second, as will Lindsay. Could something like that happen over the long term? Yes. Whether it's the Oregon Department of Ed or Chief Education Office, but it's a significantly bigger investment and a much broader conversation than what we're having today on this system.
So we'll move now to statewide longitudinal database. In the interest of time, we're happy to do a further brief of the subcommittee in writing. I will not go into an exhaustive set of benefits. We'll cover that in writing as well. But I do want to point out that as to two questions that we've received over the last couple days. One, what is the long-term impact of full-day kindergarten? What are some of the challenges that we face between high school graduation requirements and community college or, you know, public university requirements? We can answer that by looking at the data. So that's one of the benefits that I think this will serve for policymakers in terms of policy decisions and resource allocations. But more importantly, to the function of the databases that's being built, John Starr is our project or statewide longitudinal data system director, and we'll just give you a quick update on that work.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is John Starr. I am the project director for the statewide longitudinal data system. There is no black magic here, just to be open and honest. The system in and of itself manages large data. That's its primarily function. Part of the objectives of the system is to ensure student privacy. It's a very sensitive issue. We are in compliance with the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act. As a goal, we want to go above and beyond that, and we have added additional safeguards to ensure the safety and control of individual information that is currently being shared between the Higher Education Commission, K through 12, and in the future, early learnings. Part of the system in and of itself is to give a longitudinal perspective or view of aggregated student performance, basically from cradle through to career. And we will embark on early consumption of workforce data in the June timeframe of this year. So we, at this point in time, have consumed about 3 terabytes of information from our partners. That's about 1.5 billion single-spaced pages of typewritten material. So this is very, very large. It has the capability and is doing organizational assembly of the information that currently is in various different data silos. So that's its power. It allows existing information to be consolidated and grouped in such a way that you can get various different pictures over time of performance that spans from, at this point, kindergarten through secondary ed.
Post-secondary ed.
The goal is to have this as a tool for administrators, policymakers, researchers, to be able to take and look at and project programs and policies that add value to the citizens of Oregon during that period of time. It also will allow baseline setting to be able to take and measure against as we initiate new programs and be able to track and see, are we indeed adding value, are we doing improvement over a span of time. So opportunity provides easy research. This is a very powerful tool. It will give quick turnaround. It allows for analysis, predictive modeling of systems, and allows policy and decision makers the ability to make decisions based on informed information.
Thank you.
Moving forward, we're looking at expanding the depth of the system. We, at this point in time, through statute, will start to consume early learning information when they are ready for us. We've already had inquiries from private universities to share information and participate. We've been in discussion with TSPC to start to consume that information and align it. So there's a lot of opportunity here. We have a strategic plan that goes out to 2032 at this point in time. So the overall goal is to present an overall picture throughout an entire life cycle for our students.
Thank you.
Quick one.
Senator Roblin.
Good question. Are we comfortable with the quality of the data that we're putting in? I mean, I worry about, I mean, I kept a lot of data at our school. So are we comfortable with the data that's going in so that we can, when it gets to be large numbers, it makes it helpful because you don't worry about any single individual event. But are we pretty comfortable with the data we're getting and how we're getting it?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Senator Roblin. Excellent question. The long and the short of it is the data is what the data is today.
Okay.
This will be an iterative process. I will not lie to you. We've already seen instances where matching information to individuals quite iterative. John Smith turns into Jack Smith. That turns into, okay. There's several different iterations of the same individual. So this will be iterative. It will take time to gain the level of data quality that I think we all want.
Okay. Thank you. So we are at the end of our committee time, and I know we have floor session this morning in which, on the House side in particular, we are swearing in a new member today. So there is a high priority of getting to that. I fear we are going to need to hold over the end of your budget information as well as the DAS presentation until Monday. So if anybody has any more questions they want to get in, this would be a good time to get them in to build up against next week's time. But otherwise, thank you very much.
Thank
you, colleagues. And we will hold over Senate Bill 5522 and the meet. And do I bang for that?
Yeah.
For the holding over? Okay, I'll bang for the holding over. And one more time to adjourn the meeting. Thank you. Thank you.